Welcome to another episode of the Oncology on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Russ Conroy. On the heels of Myeloma Awareness Month in March, Dr. Krina Patel of the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center spoke about disparities in outcomes and clinical trial access for patients with multiple myeloma. She discussed previous research focusing on gender, race, and ethnicity as factors influencing treatment outcomes, as well as ongoing initiatives from other institutions aiming to ensure more equitable care in this patient population.
So first, I saw that you were an author of a study investigating the impact of gender on outcomes of patients undergoing autologous stem cell transplant for multiple myeloma. What was the rationale for your research?
Yeah, so this is actually one of our stem cell fellows who put this great paper together. I think as MD Anderson does the most stem cell transplants, a lot of this outcome studies really help generate other questions down the road and you know, should we be doing things differently for different patient populations? And that includes gender as well as race, ethnicity, you know, are there biological differences? Or dosing of medications that should be different, or maybe even socioeconomic differences that change safety or outcomes in general for patients. So I think this was a novel study in that there's a few others that have looked at gender, but not really very many on outcomes for myeloma patients with different treatments and stem cells specifically, because you know it is a standard of care, and I think this study shows that. Even, you know, female women patients do really well with getting access to stem cell transplant. It doesn't go as much into toxicity and there's not as much, statistically significant for the majority of the different groups of patients in terms of high risk patients that are also women versus male patients. But what was interesting, there's one group of patients, those who are less than 50 years old, that there was a significance difference in how well they do in terms of progression-free survival. And it's lower than male patients in that less than 50 years of age. Big picture, myeloma usually affects older patients, average age is 69, but we do have lots of younger patients that end up getting this. And I think what's interesting is that data right there now generates all these questions, right? So I think in the paper we discuss, you know, is it a hormonal difference? In other cancers, you know, male patients don't do as well, which is thought to lead to testosterone and melanoma, for instance. So here, does estrogen, when you're younger, you have more estrogen, does it change outcomes because of, let's say, your induction therapy or the transplant itself or maintenance? But then there's other questions like socioeconomic that we don't really address in this, but, you know, is it that younger women patients are more likely to have different stress that could also affect, you know, their response to different treatments? Their immune systems are different in times of stress. Are they taking care of other people in their family, you know, working or not working? All those different things, I think, could be potential answers. And again, I think this is a great start to more thought-provoking ways to delve into that problem.
I see. Thank you for the breakdown. I know you mentioned a couple of different aspects of the study in terms of outcomes, including progression-free survival. Were there any other pieces of interesting data to read out of that study?
Yeah, I think the biggest message is that patients, you know, women or men do really well when they get access, right? And so these were the patients that went through transplant. And the even high risk patients that, you know, as long as they get it, they can do the best possible with the tools that we have. But I think that's the biggest message, that there's not really a big difference between the two, and maybe that one group validating it and then figuring out why that is and how can we improve on that. But no major issues between toxicity or anything like that either. Another question that I've always had that this study doesn't necessarily address, but I think kind of touches on, is dosing, right? So in transplant, the dosing for melphalan is based on weight. So that does, you know, change maybe a little bit of toxicity and efficacy, and it is weight-based at least, which women are usually less heavier than men. But other treatments like len maintenance or even induction therapies, some are weight-based or, you know, based on your body surface area. But other things, there's just a flat dose. And so, for instance, lenalidomide, all my patients on maintenance, I'm supposed to give them all 10 to 15 milligrams, and it's not weight-based. And so it's, there are certain aspects that maybe we need to do more pharmacokinetic studies, or really, you know, what dose is optimal for different genders based on different biological differences. So again, that wasn't in the study, but just adds more questions for the future.
Yeah, so definitely a lot of factors considered from the sounds of it. That study mainly focused on gender, but I also saw that you were an author on another study investigating racial and ethnic differences in clinical outcomes for patients with multiple myeloma following CAR T cell therapy. And what were some of the key findings from that research?
Yeah, so another exciting project that we are hopefully going to have published as a paper soon. It was an abstract at ASH, and the paper is submitted. So I'm excited about that to come out very soon. But really, this was a 11 center consortium in the U.S. Looking at outcomes of CAR T cell therapy, Ide-cel, which was the first CAR T that got approved for myeloma. And in clinical trials, we know that for myeloma patients, we are not doing a great job of being able to get patients who are Black or Hispanic or minority patients, basically, in terms of race or ethnicity, represented on those trials. And there's a lot of research going into that and how can we improve that. But when that happens, it trickles down to standard of care then. So we don't know as much in terms of responses, side effects, toxicity. You know, are they different for, again, biologically versus socioeconomic? What factors can change these both efficacy and toxicity for patients. And so this looked at specifically patients who are Black and or Hispanic, and looked at safety mostly, as well as response rates and progression-free survival and overall survival. And the biggest, again, amazing response rates for all different groups. So Hispanic patients had a little bit lower response rate, more in the 60-70%, versus our Black patients still had a great response rate of 86% compared to our non-Hispanic, non-Black white patients, who the response rate was in the 80% as well. The biggest difference, again, for our Hispanic patients, it was a little bit lower than we expected. And we don't know exactly why, but that response rate is still better than anything else we have available for our patients. So again, the numbers are a little bit smaller, so we have to validate this, but still getting access to patients, they do well. And we see that with the PFS as well. The PFS for the patients who responded is really good still. It's actually similar to all patients on the trial. I think the toxicity piece was a little bit more interesting. For Hispanic patients, it looked like toxicity was very similar to everybody else. In our Black patients, we actually saw a higher level of inflammatory markers that were positive or higher at baseline, including ferritin levels and CRP levels, which in a multivariate analysis didn't necessarily say it was related to myeloma burden, which it can be sometimes. And safety wise, patients had a little bit more higher grade CRS if they were Black, and they ended up being in the hospital for longer. So in terms of hospital utilization, it changed. Again, it's not, this is not necessarily a correlation or a causation, but more of a correlation. And the question again comes back to, is this because a hospital stayed longer because the doctors and teams were worried about worsening CRS, or their CRS lasted longer and that's why they kept them in the hospital, or because of socioeconomic status issues that, they weren't going to be able to come back for rides and, for the daily appointments. And so there's still a lot of unknowns as to why this happened, but at least it tells us that there was some type of difference, at least in this retrospective series. And I think the next step is going to be, how do we build on this?
Is there any ongoing research further investigating disparities in multiple myeloma outcomes that you feel is worth mentioning?
Yeah. So I remembered you had that question. That's why I didn't answer it in one breath, like the question before. But this is a huge area of interest, I think, for everybody that does myeloma research, but especially MD Anderson, where, we're actually having our first health disparities and oncology conference next month in New York with Cornell. And so it is a big institution, objective for us, right? To improve clinical research participation for our minority patients, but also access to all the, you know, standard of care therapies that a lot of our patients in the US aren't able to get to. So specifically for us, one of my fantastic first-year fellows, Dr. Kristen Dillard, was a second author on that last ASH abstract that we just talked about. And we actually just submitted a grant for her to continue this evaluation of patients and sort of looking at more specific questions. And so her big projects are going to be looking at outcomes for the patients who were on clinical trials at MD Anderson. So we had the highest enrollment of both Black and or Hispanic patients onto our earlier line CAR T studies, so KARMA 2 and KARMA 3. Those looked at ide-cel in KARMA 2 was for high risk patients, and KARMA 3 was our first randomized phase 3 CAR T study that looked at CAR T versus standard of care options for patients in earlier lines, lines 3 to 5. And so, again, because we had so many patients participate on these trials, she's going to look at outcomes for earlier line therapy for our minority patients and look at sort of our standard of care patients retrospectively. We're going to be doing ancestry studies, so translational studies that will be put together with Dr. Michelle Hildebrandt, who is a phenomenal epidemiologist and in our lymphoma myeloma department and has a lot of studies, actually the most, I would say, for Hispanic patient outcomes in myeloma, especially smoldering and MGUS patients. So she's helping with sort of these more relapsed refractory patients undergoing novel immune therapies. And then, you know, again, looking at the social determinants of health. So the socioeconomic factors that affect things, not just biologic. So we'll have lots of surveys that we're going to be doing with patients to really, you know, come down on what are the obstacles that get in our patients' way of being able to get these novel treatments or the aftercare so that we can decrease, you know, toxicities for them. And then I think after that, the future really is about prospective studies, looking at, you know, biomarkers and kind of looking further into that CRP level and that ferritin level being higher. You know, is that because of comorbidities? Is that because of the biology of the myeloma being different for our minority patients? So again, just a lot of great things that are going to come down the pipeline, hopefully answering more, you know, deeper questions from what our abstract started with.
Yeah, so definitely a lot of interesting research to come in the future. And are there any other initiatives that are going on to mitigate clinical trial disparities for patients?
Yeah, no, I think that's a fantastic question. I think the biggest thing is, you know, because a lot of these are pharma-sponsored trials, we really need help from our pharma groups and people are. They're actually, the FDA, our pharma partners, our big groups like the International Myeloma Foundation, you know, IMS, MMRF, all these myeloma-specific foundations are doing a really great job of bringing this to the, you know, forefront, Leukemia Lymphoma Society, you know, all the way from having specific Zoom meetings or meetings for patients who are minorities to go over, you know, any questions that they could have on just care for myeloma, but also clinical trials, you know, all the way up to getting sponsors to be able to give us, you know, financial assistance for patients who maybe, you know, don't have a car and can't come back and forth for daily visits. You know, we don't want them on a bus because they're higher risk of infection. So, you know, how can we get them rides back and forth for their appointments? How can we get them, you know, hotel stays closer by, meals, you know, covered when they're at the hospital all day, all kinds of, you know, again, trying to figure out what the biggest issues on barriers are that then we can fix those problems. You know, at the state level for Texas, we have something called patient financial assistance, where some of our patients who don't have insurance approval, but are, you know, residents of Texas, we should be able to treat them. So we have our social workers and everybody else really, you know, working with patients to make sure that they know about this. And if they are eligible, that we get them in. And we've actually treated quite a few patients who have PFA with cell therapy. And our plan is to continue to do that with our new novel, you know, bispecific therapies. And so I think, again, top, bottom, bottom, top, everybody is really looking at this. And that's what you need to make any kind of change, because it's multiple obstacles, not just one. And I think it's a great time where things are changing, in my opinion, exponentially. And so we just have to keep it going so that we can actually, you know, bring this to our patients. I think we've identified the problems, and we've learned it's complex. So now we're identifying the more complex part of it. And we've gotten allies and we've gotten everyone's buy-in. And now it's how do we, you know, push it out so that the majority of our patients can get these resources for better outcomes.
I see. And I know you mentioned a couple of different agencies. I think it was the FDA being one of them that are kind of contributing to this effort. But in terms of like other oncologists and institutions of that sort, what should they be doing to help mitigate these disparities and ensure more equitable care for this patient population?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think each center, based on where they're located, are going to have probably different obstacles that they're working with. So I've heard, you know, that for some folks, it like in the South, it really is about trust, right? And saying, you're making me a guinea pig, or, you know, just from the history of our medical profession and things that have been done in the past that were not okay. And really being able to say that, no, this is really for your benefit, you know, why we're doing these studies, why it's a clinical trial. What does that mean? I think a lot of my patients, when they don't know if they're really interested or not, I give them time to think about it and come up with questions and have another appointment with them later, even a virtual appointment or a telephone appointment, since I can do that, and really, you know, spend that time to answer everything and to really build that trust and be very honest. You know, there are some trials that are phase one trials where we don't know if things are going to work, and it is a little bit more unknown, and we're trying to figure out what the side effects are and what the efficacy is going to be. Then there's trials that are phase two and three where we have some data at least, right? And again, just being honest about what that means, and what other options there are and how good those options are. You know, I think that takes a lot of time to discuss with those patients, or with any patient, but I think that's what our patients really need, and setting up multiple potential appointments for that. The other piece is getting support, you know, so my research team, my clinical team, and I know I'm in Houston, which is one of the most diverse cities, but really we have people of all backgrounds on all these teams. And these are the people that are helping our patients navigate all of this too, right? And it really helps to have people that look like you, that sort of understand where you're coming from, so that even if you don't feel comfortable asking that question, they might be able to say, is this what you're worried about? You know, without the patient having to bring it up sometimes. So again, we're all different in terms of what we're comfortable speaking about and not, but you have people that are from the same background, they can at least anticipate maybe some of the questions. And so I think that's really important too.
And overall, what do you hope your colleagues take away from this conversation?
Yeah, so I think instead of thinking that, you know, this idea of minority patients not being able to go on to trials, or, you know, even looking at outcomes for women versus men, it really is about unity and not trying to figure out ways to make us, you know, seem different from each other. It's more about that there are differences and figuring out those differences. And if we change the way we do our research in the future to really be inclusive of all those differences, you're actually going to improve outcomes for a lot more people, right? Rather than having one patient population and using that data to try to extrapolate to all the different biology, again, socioeconomic status, you know, social determinants of health. I mean, there's so much more than even just biology that affects how we're doing day to day. And I think learning about that is actually going to help all of us be better at what we do, physicians, researchers, and help our patients at the max level.
I see. Thank you for all that. Those were all the questions that I had. Was there anything else that you wanted to bring up that we didn't discuss previously?
I guess I can just add for the FDA, you know, they're actually really involved in trying to find ways to, you know, increase minority participation on clinical trials in different ways. I mean, making requirements, which different sponsors are doing differently. So some sponsors are actually opening up clinical trial arms that are specific to minority patients, and you know, others are incentivizing, you know, meaning that, you know, if you are able to enroll patients with minorities, you know, just saying that that is actually one of the big goals of these studies. In the past, you know, goals of the studies was how many patients can you get on, and really, you know, try to get the study done so you can see those outcomes in a timely manner, make sure we're doing all of this. And adding that as, you know, one of the big goals for the big studies. And I think that's really, really important. So the FDA being involved in requiring that, I think is a huge step.
Yeah, that does sound like a pretty big initiative. Well, in that case, I want to thank you again for taking the time to do this interview. I do appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology on the Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available, or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology on the Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us at Twitter @cancernetwork without the O. We're on Facebook and LinkedIn @cancer-network.